Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Oncology Decoded. I'm your host with Manoj Bhupathi, and with me is Ben Garmazi. We are recording on a Friday, and we're going to be talking about prostate cancer in 2025 and how it changed over how our practice has changed over the last year and how it's going to transform our change this year moving forward. We really thank you for all your support and encouragement, as well as supporting us and listening to us. We hope that you find this is helpful. We encourage you to follow us on X at Oncology Decoded and email us at podcast@oncologydecoded.com. And Ben, you want to start?
Yeah, great. And first of all, go back and listen to our kidney bladder episode that already are in either your iTunes feed or Spotify feed or wherever it may be. This is going to be our prostate feed, and we're at the in that finalizing 2025, moving into 2026 moment. So again, what did we do last time is what we're going to do this time. We're going to talk about what we think is the most relevant and practice-changing information for the medical oncologists out there with any kind of patients with GU cancer in prostate. So specifically, we're going to start with, I think, the easiest one here. We saw a new FDA approval in the summer, and it's one that we kind of had an FDA approval with already in certain situations in prostate cancer. That's darolutamide being approved via Aricin's in triplet combination with docetaxel, also being approved in non-metastatic prostate cancer. But now, based on ARANOTE, a study that was not really conducted in the United States, but showed that the ADT plus darolutamide versus ADT alone had a progression-free survival benefit, which was not surprising in patients with metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. So the FDA now has granted the approval as a doublet. So you can give darolutamide as a doublet. You can give darolutamide as a triplet in combination with docetaxel. Manoj, was there any surprise around that?
No, not at all. I mean, to be honest with you, I think it just made it a little bit easier to get darolutamide because there was already use of that in community practice anyway. But personally, I like darolutamide. I think it's a good drug. I don't know if you how much you've used it outside of triplet. I have used it in some patients for the as a doublet, and I think the neurocognitive effects tend to be favorable. So I tend to like it. So this just makes it easier to use.
Yeah, I completely agree. I use it in more elderly patients, patients with other neurocognitive disorders like Parkinson's. I have a few of those patients, and it seems to work pretty well. There was some controversy around the approval that it didn't have statistically significant overall survival yet, while apalutamide, enzalutamide, and abiraterone did. Of course, those drugs were approved in a different decade and in a different situation when those trials were run, where there were less options and overall survival was maybe easier to get. Did you have any qualms about that? Did you buy into any of that controversy?
I mean, honestly, I don't think so. I think it's just time, as you're just alluding to, right? I think it's more of lead time bias than anything else because you just don't have the longer term follow-up with darolutamide with ADT. But I think clinically what we see is that all these drugs are very similar to each other. The side effect profile is actually what's different among all of them, right? How often you see these patients, how often you do blood work, and the neurocognitive and seizures, those are probably the big ones that I take away. But I don't, the overall survival specific endpoint, not seeing it doesn't affect my use of it.
Yeah, I'm also not concerned about that as well. We know that it's a good drug in other settings, and in this setting it seems to work quite well. So I don't think there's any controversy that we need to discuss on that. We can move forward to two studies that were presented at ESMO. So that wasn't that long ago that we broke these down on the podcast, but we can't do a 2025 recap episode without discussing PSMA addition and CAPItello-281. So let's start about PSMA
Wait,
addition. Go
before we
ahead,
go
go
there,
ahead.
what about ASCO? We saw Amplitude at ASCO, so we probably should talk about Amplitude first, no?
You want to go to Amplitude first? Okay, I was saving my PARP inhibitors, but let's go to Amplitude because there's another FDA approval. You want to do the Manoj wants to do all the FDA approvals up front. So let's do that. So Amplitude got an FDA approval in December 2025. So just squeaking right on in, but a little bit different than maybe some of us were expecting. So remember, Amplitude is the trial where we compared in the frontline setting ADT, abiraterone, and the PARP inhibitor niraparib versus ADT and abiraterone. Now, docetaxel was allowed in the mHSPC setting. I think 14, 15% of patients got it. So let's forget about those patients and consider this really a triplet versus a doublet. And it was in all HRR or selected HRR panel mutations. It wasn't just BRCA1 or BRCA2. The intention to treat population included numerous of those mutations. And in the intention to treat population, there was a statistically significant radiographic progression-free survival benefit. A hazard ratio was 0.63, which is pretty darn good. Now, the FDA approval came in early December, not just for BRCA1 and 2, like the magnitude population in the CRPC setting with this drug, but just for BRCA2. And they did what they've started to do with PARP inhibitors. The FDA took the trial, took the cohort, and sliced it and diced it and took a look. And let's dig into the reasons they came up with this. If you look at the BRCA2 mutated population, the radiographic progression-free survival hazard ratio is 0.46. I can't give you medians because they're not reached in the group that got niraparib. They're 26 months in the control arm, which is about what we would expect in this patient population. But in the non-BRCA2, but still HR mutated population, the hazard ratio for radiographic progression-free survival was 0.88 with a confidence interval that way expands over one. So therefore, the FDA said, not, you're not going to just get a label in your intention to treat population all because the study was positive. You're not going to get a label in the BRCA1/2 population, even though we did that in the CRPC setting for your drug. We're actually going to restrict it further and just give it in the BRCA2 population. So I think this was a little bit of a surprise. At least I was surprised. I thought if they were going to limit it, it might go to BRCA1 and 2. But I don't know. Were you surprised or did you see this coming?
No, I was surprised. I was expecting BRCA1, BRCA2. I was not expecting BRCA2 alone. And we know that, at least based on clinical experience, BRCA2 patients are the one that derive lower of this benefit, and the PARP inhibitor therapy tends to be longer in those group of patients. They tend to tolerate pretty well. So we know that, at least from clinical experience, and historically, when all the PARP inhibitors have been approved, and you go back all the way to our original Lynparza approval, right? It was also you had cohort one, which is primarily BRCA, and then you had cohort two, which looked at all these other mutations and kind of got a blanket approval. Here, it's very different, as you're saying, and it's really the BRCA2 patients. One, it reinforces that we have to do genetic testing up front, right? We have to check all these patients, both somatic and germline, to make sure that they don't have this, because this is a great option now for this group of patients who have that. And two, from a side effect standpoint, I think we have to figure out what we're going to do from a longer term standpoint, right? See, the risk of the pancytopenias with PARPs is not small. And so I think that's where the bigger challenge is going to be as to who's going to be the right candidate for this. But it was definitely an interesting label that we have not seen before.
Yeah, and it's significantly higher grade 3 and 4 adverse events in the intervention arm with the PARP inhibitor. Grade 3 and 4 anemia was nearly a third of patients, almost 30% of patients. So a lot of transfusions, a lot more fatigue in that group, all to be expected, but a clearly statistically significant rPFS signal. We'll see what overall survival does. It's not mature yet. And you asked, you said, we'll see what kind of patients to give it to. I've been thinking about this, right? Because in this patient population, we know that BRCA2 mutated patients have a worse prognosis, right? Now, our options are the doublet, an ADT and an ARPI agent, a triplet with niraparib, or a triplet with docetaxel, right? And to me, most patients, I think I would give the PARP inhibitor to. If you were low volume and low risk via, charted or whatever these other criteria we use, maybe the doublet alone or the doublet with, SBRT or something like that. But in patients with, any other type of risk stratification, I think I probably would layer in the PARP inhibitor if I felt like they had good support and able to get back and forth to clinic more frequently.
I don't know what I would do. And it's an interesting definition that you just gave, which was the volume of based on charted or anything like that, right? Because I think the era of oligometastatic disease, it's evolving. And so when you think about lower volume patients and you're quote unquote going to try to cure them with radiotherapy and PARPs and, or radiotherapy and ADT plus ARPI, then where does this more extensive disease pattern fall, right? So if you have a, mid 60-year-old, 70-year-old patient that presents with widely metastatic bone disease, only, and then you have a BRCA2 in that, is that the patient that you're going to give the PARP inhibitor to versus the patient who has same disease but also lung metastasis or liver metastasis? I tend to think about liver metastasis a little differently and think of them as more aggressive even. So that group of patients, I maybe think more about the chemo as opposed to PARP inhibitor.
I
So
gotta
I'm
push back.
a,
I'm gonna push back, Manoj. I gotta push back because you're gonna, our listeners are gonna have a patient in clinic on Monday, right? And they gotta know what to
yeah.
do. And look, let's go to Triton 3. Different PARP inhibitor, different setting, right? Rucaparib in the mCRPC setting. Docetaxel lost to the PARP inhibitor in a BRCA patient population. So for that reason, I gotta extrapolate something because we haven't run the trial. I gotta do something. And on Monday, most patients, if, unless they say, I just want to get through my 18 weeks of chemo and then be cruising on a doublet, which is a very rational, very reasonable shared decision making, right? Absolutely a benefit potentially to the docetaxel. But if they say, I want whatever you think is the most aggressive and best option, I'm going to go, I think I'm going to go with niraparib on almost all these patients, unless I was concerned, even actually, I'm going to say it now. I'm going to just go out there and say it. Even if I was concerned that they had like molecular variant like TP53, RB1P10, I'm still probably going to lean on the PARP inhibitor. I don't, again, we all know that we're not sure what's right here. And there is data in this trial to suggest you could give your 6 cycles of docetaxel and then layer in the PARP inhibitor if you wanted. That would be an option. It's been proven, quote unquote, safe by allowing that on the trial. 1 out of 6 patients did have that. So, you know, I
I'm going to
guess I
push
don't
back a
know.
little bit too,
Go ahead, push.
because you're comparing a castration-resistant
Yes,
population
I
to a
am. That's
hormone-sensitive population.
all I got.
I understand, but it's a different biology. Hormone-resistant biology is far more aggressive than hormone-sensitive biology. You tend to think of hormone-sensitive disease as being at least stable for a longer period of time, right, compared to hormone resistance. So for me, it's a little hard to use the hormone-resistant data to say that I'm going to use chemo over a PARP inhibitor. So I don't know. I think it's a conversation to have, but I don't know that I'm convinced that I would go to PARP alone. I may still think about chemo in that group. Maybe it's chemo and then maintenance with PARP plus ARPI. I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. You could do that. I have no problem with whatever you pick because we don't know. And I think the key is we need to figure that out. And look, if you're listening to this podcast and you have an opinion, tag us on social media, tag us in our inbox. We'd love to hear from you because I don't think there is a consensus out there. Clearly, there's some dissent amongst the two of us on this call, and that's okay. I will just say that yes, the biology is different, but the DNA replication forks may be the same. I don't know. But anyways, we will move on. But actually, before we move on, I'm going to jump. I'm going to do something Manoj doesn't want me to do. I'm going to jump into CRPC for a hot second because TALAPRO's final overall survival analysis, the TALAPRO-2 final overall survival analysis was released this fall and published. And this was, if you recall, the talazoparib enzalutamide data in the mCRPC frontline setting, most of these patients being progressing on ADT monotherapy, which is a patient population that doesn't exist as commonly in our clinics these days because most patients are being treated with an ARPI up front. But what we saw was the overall survival looked really good. And clearly, this is a nice benefit. And what is unique potentially, and the only reason I want to bring it up, what is potentially unique about this combination is that it does seem to maybe work in more mutations than just BRCA1 and 2. So remember, we talked about how niraparib and the magnitude study in the same population that was paired with abiraterone seemed to really derive most of the benefit in that BRCA1/2 population. If you remember back to the cohort studies from PROPEL from olaparib monotherapy that you were alluding to, Manoj, back in 2015, when I think is when that initial paper was. It could have been later. I don't remember. It was cohort A and B, and the A was BRCA1/2, and they put ATM in there just to make us all confused. You know, that seemed to work better in cohort A, and then they did further diced it and it seemed to work better in BRCA1 and 2 than ATM because until this study, nothing seemed to work that well in ATM. However, TALAPRO-2 did have a signal of efficacy in some ATM mutations. So I don't know if that's because there were more of the true biallelic losses in this trial versus in the other trial where we know that they work a little bit better in those, or maybe there's something different about the PARP trapping effect of talazoparib relative to the kinase inhibition effects of niraparib and olaparib. Either which way, it was interesting. It was published, and we await TALAPRO-3, which is a metastatic hormone sensitive trial in the same patient population as Amplitude, to see where the benefit is there and ultimately what happens with FDA regulatory approval if that study is positive.
Let me ask you a hypothetical question, Ben. Let's say TLPRO3 is also positive for hormone sensitive, and all things being equal, it'll be the same. What would you do? Or if it's negative, actually, that'd be more interesting to me. What happens if that study is negative for hormone sensitive?
Oh gosh. Well, if that's negative, you start to think, you look at the BRCA2 subgroup on the forest plot, you do what you're not supposed to do, right? Where it's not statistically powered necessarily to answer that question. If it looks like there's a signal of efficacy in the BRCA2, I'm still going to be given niraparib, I think. And if it doesn't look like there's a signal of efficacy, that's when maybe for a patient that's willing to do chemotherapy, I'm going to start to agree with you.
So TLPRO3 may be our
And for those
defining
of you
moment.
listening, the only reason he asked that question is so that I would say I agree with him. See, you could tell. He knows what he's doing. He's smart. Okay. Well, I think that's good. Anything else we want to say about PARP inhibition before we move back to ESMO of 2025?
No, I think that's it. I think right now it's an exciting time for PARP inhibitors in general, and more yet to come.
So I'm going to start with the molecularly driven study at ESMO because we were talking about BRCA mutations, right? So PTEN loss. An AKT inhibitor, capivasertib, in capivasertib-281 metastatic hormone-sensitive patient population, abiraterone plus capivasertib versus abiraterone, triplet versus doublet again. It's kind of the same, except instead of looking at niraparib with a BRCA population, we're now looking at PTEN loss. The PTEN loss was done by IHC, so that is a test that we're not commonly sending on our patients. It is a test that one could figure out how to send if there was an FDA approval around this space. Obviously, we get HER2 IHC and all other sorts of IHCs and other solid tumors. But what it was a positive study, an RPFS benefit of 33 versus 25 months, with a hazard ratio that was modest, 0.81. Overall survival, nowhere near statistical significance yet. Hazard ratio of 0.9, p-value of 0.4. And then they broke it down and they said, okay, this is a positive study in the intention to treat population. If you had 90% PTEN loss or greater, there's a benefit. But let's also now slice and dice. 95, 97, 99, right? Those patients that had more PTEN loss derived more benefit. So 99% loss or more did the best, right? And between 90 and 95 did the worst relatively to the control arm. Now, it's not like the control arm outperformed capivasertib in any of these arms, but the relative benefit was increased as the PTEN loss went down. Now, while there is a positive study here and there's a clear separation of the curves, I will say the toxicities on this program were also perhaps more robust for an oral pill than many of us would have thought. Not that the PARP inhibitors don't have toxicity, but this one causes diarrhea, hyperglycemia, fatigue, other issues that we saw. And we will see how the FDA rules on this one. What were your thoughts about capivasertib?
I think it's an interesting study. I just don't know that it's going to be a therapy that we're going to use up front. I think it's a little bit challenging, right? Like just thinking about my day-to-day clinic operations and how do I test for PTEN IHC? That's a challenge. And how long is that going to take for me to get back from a treatment standpoint for me to decide this? And then the next thing is IHC versus NGS. If I see it on NGS, but I don't see it on IHC, how do I interpret that? What do I do with that? I don't know. I mean, I don't know if you know. I don't know how
I can
often
tell
we actually
you
see
there's
that.
some data from other studies that perhaps the NGS might even be better than the IHC. And the reason they designed the study this way, though, is because ex-US, it was easier to do an IHC program than an NGS. I heard that, the problem is we don't know that. That's not validated, right? That's not validated. And I agree with you with all the complications. And then you're saying, well, is capivasertib better than docetaxel? All right. 18 weeks of docetaxel might be easier to tolerate than capivasertib. There are some patients who never want chemo. It is a targeted paradigm. I just don't know. I agree with you. I don't know.
Side effects is what is a little bit more challenging. And we've seen PTEN inhibitors in prostate cancer being developed in hormone resistance, right? We've seen ipatasertib a few years ago in hormone resistant. It was a challenging drug. It was not an easy drug to be administered for those PTEN deficient patients. And that was based on NGS, of course, not on IHC. So this is an interesting way of looking at it. I just think there's a lot more clinical challenges on a day-to-day for adoption. Granted, we can get over those if Data seems
Right.
very compelling, but at this point, I'm not so convinced that the data is incredibly convincing to implement a Monday morning or even like the next few months. But we'll see
And
where it goes.
I agree. I want to see another data cut. And I'm not saying no, but I'm saying right now it wouldn't necessarily be the first thing that I would draw in my tool belt. And the other thing I guess we should mention, it is a 2025 podcast. There was data presented in 2025, an abstract form that docetaxel and MHSVC may be even more relevant in PTEN loss patients. So PTEN loss actually may be a biomarker for taxane use in this patient population. So I think that's another critical piece of this puzzle. It's not like we don't have other drugs in this space. Okay, so we're good to move on. We're going to move on to lutetium, radioligand. Everyone loves to talk about radioligand therapy, right? It's the hottest thing in prostate cancer. Makes you glow. It's radiographic or radioisotopes. But so PSMA addition came out in ESMO, right? So PSMA addition was, we all know lutetium from, the studies that got it approved in the castration-resistant population, the refractory setting, and then moved up with PSMA4 into that kind of hormone switch patient population, beating out an ARPI switch control arm. And now this is in the more metastatic hormone-sensitive prostate cancer setting. And giving 6 cycles of lutetium and adding that into ADT plus ARPI versus the doublet ADT plus ARPI alone. So triplet versus doublet study again. You had to have lesions that had PSMA avidity, but it was not as controlled as some of the other studies. And part of that reason is because it was initially developed as a cooperative group study that then got taken over by Novartis. So there was a little bit more kind of friendliness into the ability to get patients on. If you look at it, it was positive for RPFS. I mean, it's not reached versus not reached for medians, but the hazard ratio was 0.72. The interim overall survival, which isn't done yet, right? It's not fully mature, was 0.84. P-value not statistically significant, but trending in the right direction. So this was interesting. I think this was exciting. I think there were a lot of criticisms when this came out for how much excitement was expected.
I was
Am I
gonna
reading the
say,
room? Yeah.
yeah, I was gonna say, I was underwhelmed by it when I saw the results. I was expecting more of a, this is what we're gonna do going forward result, and I don't know that I got that.
I kind of agree with you, and I think some of it comes down to the trial design. I think we know lutetium is active in this space or in prostate cancer, right? It has an overall survival benefit in one setting. It showed nice radiographic progression-free survival in PSMA4, and now it's here. I think the problem is the set it and forget it 6 cycles in this combination, right? You're giving 6 cycles of a drug that targets PSMA, which is an active biomarker that we can scan on a PET scan. And in the hormone-sensitive setting, when we debulk these tumors and that PSMA level goes down, because the cells are dying so effectively with our hormonal therapy, they're causing more adverse events than relative efficacy. Once you get after those first 2 cycles, maybe three, it's going to be dependent on the patient. But if you look even further into the data set, they look at the FACT-P scores and all those quality of life things that I'm going to be honest, I don't really like. But it actually showed perhaps a trend towards unfavorability with the addition of lutetium, with very high rates of grade 1 and 2 dry mouth. And some of that's going to be permanent. And grade 2 dry mouth doesn't sound so bad because it's not grade 3 or 4. But grade 2 dry mouth is a bear, right? Like grade 3, we're talking about like feeding tubes. So I think the issue is when you debulk the tumor burden, the lutetium is going into the salivary glands and going perhaps into the renal tubules and to the GI side of GI tract and radiating and perhaps causing more long-term side effects than it's worth if we're going to give all 6 cycles. Now, I think the counter of that is we've seen other data presented with 2 cycles followed by docetaxel in the metastatic hormone sensitive, and that seems to be mildly effective. So maybe some kind of priming with lutetium that's not all 6 cycles would be a win for patients. It's not clear that patients should get all 6 cycles. And if this does get FDA approved, and I think we'll find out, we don't know. If this does get FDA approved, and I give this, I'm probably not going to give all 6 cycles. I'm going to probably do an interim scan after 2 or 3. And if I don't see much, or I'm going to probably pull it off. But what are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the side effects is what worry me the most, right? So we didn't talk about the nephrotoxicity. We didn't talk about the pancytopenia. We didn't, dry mouth is certainly there, but some of these other things, you can get chronic renal insufficiency or like basically renal toxicity just from exposure to Pluvicto. And so I think that's a real toxicity in this group of patients that can actually do really well for a long period of time. You're talking about years of therapy and bone marrow failure that can happen too. So I think that scares me a little bit in terms of figuring out who to use. Now, one of the things that would be interesting is, we looked at, or we are looking at now, delayed castration with the use of Pluvicto in kind of oligomet prostate cancer patients. Now, to your point, if you're debulking these patients with hormonal blockade and you're adding in Pluvicto, does it make sense to give them ADT as well? Can you just give them Pluvicto and then see what happens, and not do androgen blockade? No, I don't. I know we don't have any data on this whatsoever, and it hasn't been looked at. But if we show that it works in oligomet, where you can delay castration and Pluvicto with radiation therapy works, maybe that's the new where we need to go for hormone-sensitive prostate cancer and not do hormonal blockade at all. I don't
And
know.
I think that's a much nicer question, right? I think you're right, because otherwise it is a bit complicated to see how this works. Radioligands don't do as good a job in theory at wiping up oligometastatic disease because the dosimetry doesn't get enough radiation to those few single cell micrometastatic deposits. So I think you're right there. I think that's an interesting question. I don't think if you gave Pluvicto alone, it would cure a patient probably, but I do think that it could certainly delay castration and maintain quality of life for the men who want to be ADT sparing. So I would support that trial if it came across my desk, and maybe you'll lead it one day. But I think it's a very interesting concept, and I agree. We're also probably going to see other molecules that could maybe pair with it for ADT sparing, right, for a metastatic patient in the future. And I hope as we get into 2026, 2027, and 2028, we have some more of those options for our patients.
Let me ask you this, Ben. So now we talked about PSMA addition, we talked about amplitude, talked about Capitello, and you mentioned ARANOTE, for hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. And we already know about TITAN, we know about STAMPEDE, we know about LATITUDE, we already know about all those other studies for hormone-sensitive prostate cancer as well. And we obviously know about the triplet combination for hormone-sensitive prostate cancer as well. I'm going to ask you a scenario. Tell me what you're going to do tomorrow, because I think that's what our listeners are really going to be wanting to know. I'm going to give you two scenarios, one with an alteration and one without an alteration. So you have a de novo, healthy individual, hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. Again, no alteration, no significant comorbidities, ECOG of one. What are you going to treat them with? And widely metastatic, bone and lymph node.
Widely metastatic bone and lymph node, ECOG 1, de novo, and you said no moleculars?
No molecular alteration. And, unsomatic or germline.
And PSA?
PSA is 500.
Okay, I'm gonna give Aricin. I'm gonna give docetaxel, ADT, and darolutamide.
Triplet.
Triplet. That's a high volume, high PSA. We gotta debulk that. We gotta drive that PSA down to under 0.2. That's what I'm going with. Am I right? Did I pass?
I would do the same. I'm just,
There we go. I passed then.
yeah.
I passed. Okay.
What about if you have a BRCA 2?
Well, I already told you what I was going to do.
Yeah, I know.
I'm going to give niraparib.
You're going to give
And you don't
niraparib.
like my reasons why, and that's okay. But that's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to change. And the reason is I got to somehow in my mind make a concept between how do I choose between a blunt tool like a taxane and a more relatively, though it's not precise tool like a PARP inhibitor. And to me, if they're relatively younger and can handle the side effects of PARP long term, I'm going to try it.
Let me ask you, same scenario, but this time it's bone and liver mets with the BRCA 2.
I'm going to give the PARP inhibitor, and I don't know that that's right. Same reason, same logic.
I think I would give chemo and then maybe give PARP as maintenance, but I don't know that
I
I would
like
give
that
PARP
idea.
alone.
So, like, that's a good idea. Give six cycles of your ADT, abiraterone, and docetaxel via PEACE1 instead of Aricin's, right? And then
Sure.
after six cycles, you could throw in, if the PSA was still detectable, the PARP inhibitor. I think that that is totally reasonable and valid. It's highly aggressive, but sure, I don't have a problem with it. I still don't know that that's necessarily what I would do unless I was worried about impending visceral crisis or something like that.
Yeah.
So I failed
What
that
would you
one. So I got one right. I got a 50% on the test. I'll take
Oh,
it.
we got three scenarios, right? We
It
got three
rounds up.
scenarios.
Oh, we got three scenarios.
We had three scenarios. We agreed on two of them. Well, the last one with the visceral mets, I'm not sure. I think I would give chemo.
Fair enough.
Liver mets, I tend to worry about those differentiating more into
Absolutely.
more neuroendocrine differentiation. So I think I'd want to be more aggressive, especially if the PSA is, if it's not as 500, right? So if the PSA is lower, let's say 150 with visceral mets, those are patients I'd be a little bit more cautious about and probably try chemo first instead of the PARP
Okay, poll the audience. We'll see. We'll
Yeah.
see. All right. So moving on, I think there's one other. We're talking a lot about lutetium and chemo. Well, let's talk about the Canadian study from ESMO. Second line, comparing the sequencing of lutetium followed by docetaxel versus docetaxel followed by lutetium. It was actually set up to be a superiority study to show that giving lutetium first might be better. In fact, the opposite happened, right? There was a, RPFS benefit by starting with docetaxel first by about 2 months. And there was a RPFS two benefit as well, which means like the time you're on the second drug, and an overall survival that was surprisingly 4 months better if you got the docetaxel first. So this, I think, was a little unexpected, but shows us what we always wished we had seen in PSMAfore would be if they had allowed taxane in that control arm where you gave lutetium versus ARPI switch, how would it have fared against a taxane? And maybe the taxane would have won. We don't know that. This is a phase two study. It's a pretty large phase two study, but it's not as rigorous and as statistically robust as a phase three study. They also looked at biomarkers. We always talk about, well, if the SUV is really high, they're going to do really well with lutetium. And if the SUV is really low, maybe we'll do chemo, right? I've said that. I'm pretty sure you've said that, but I won't throw you under the bus. I know I've said it.
I've said it.
But and they looked at those who got higher SUV and lower SUV. And I'll say the SUV was prognostic. Those with the higher SUV did better than those with the lower SUV, but it was not predictive, which says if you had a higher SUV, you did better with lutetium and with docetaxel, right? So you couldn't pick between the treatments based on the SUV, but the SUV did guide how well you were likely to do across this sequencing. So I think this was a really nice study. I do think it's at the point where, before this came out, I was saying, oh, you have a high SUV and, you don't have crazy amounts of disease, so go to lutetium instead of chemo. We'll do chemo after. Now I'm talking to all of my patients. Hey, we have chemo, we have lutetium. Here are the relative pros and cons of both. How aggressive do you want to be? And if they say they want to be maximally aggressive, then I'm signing them up for chemo first for a lot of those patients, not all, but for a lot of those patients. How are you approaching it? Did this move the needle at all for you?
No, it's same actually. It actually moved the needle back, right?
Yeah.
So PSMA, when PSMA4 came out, it was exciting because it was like, okay, well, we knew ARPI switch after ARPI was not the great, but at least we have an option to do Pluvicto. So to me, what it shows is that it's not a good idea to do an ARPI switch, and it's probably not a good idea to go to Pluvicto. Probably better to go to chemotherapy, especially if you have any of the genetic alterations that we were talking about, right? P10, P53, RB1, any of those, that it makes the argument even stronger that you probably should go to chemo more than anything else. And I think it highlights to me the importance of chemotherapy in hormone-resistant prostate cancer is it's there, and we need to be mindful of that.
And I completely agree. And I think what it also says is we know lutetium is a good molecule. We know it has a survival advantage in CRPC. However, it does seem to have a lot of downstream side effects, right? While docetaxel also has a lot of downstream side effects, it does seem to maybe have less. Maybe you can sequence more therapies and save lutetium for the end. We don't know these things, but it does bring up some hypotheses that perhaps giving chemo earlier and saving your lutetium is a sequencing strategy that could be effective. Of course, lutetium is moving up and up and up, and that train in across the United States has really left the building. But I think the key here on this study, I don't think you're wrong to give lutetium over chemo. It's not that big a difference. Lutetium is more patient friendly than chemotherapy. It's every 6 weeks instead of every 3 weeks. Those things matter, right? None of these drugs seem to cure patients in this setting of the disease. So it's totally shared decision making, but it does exactly do what you're saying. We have all these new fancy toys, and part of our job, right? Our day job when we're not doing this podcast is to help develop the next generation of fancy toys, right? Because we're both heavily involved in research through Sarah Cannon Research Institute. But what I will say is that while we're developing all these new fancy toys, Dosis Haxel is still pretty decent, right? And we have to keep that in mind. And it's not as bad as other chemotherapies and other solid tumors. And we can get men through it, and it seems to help. So I think that's another thing that we just have to stay grounded in 2026, that the old drugs still work.
Couldn't have said it better. So again, similar scenarios. So hormone-resistant prostate cancer. You gave your whatever your drug of choice up front, and let's say you did not use Pluvicto, all right? Because this is assuming that these patients have been treated for a while. So you basically gave ADT ARPI with or without chemotherapy for hormone-sensitive prostate cancer. Now you're seeing progressive disease. You have a genetic alteration with BRCA2. Actually, let's say BRCA1 or ATM actually instead of BRCA2. What are you going to do next? No visceral metastasis.
So BRCA1, I'm going to give PARP inhibitor. And
So what's going to be your PARP inhibitor of choice? Are you going to give them
it
olaparib or are you going
depends
to
what
give them
they,
the
so if they had been on abiraterone, which there's, still 10, 20% of the population that I see is on that, then I'm going to switch and I'm going to give the talazoparib enzalutamide combination because at least the Abi to Enza has a little bit of something. Or I'm going to give olaparib monotherapy, but I'm not going to stay the abiraterone, keep abiraterone on when we're already resistant to it and given niraparib, right? So depending on how aggressive the patient wants to be and the co-pays and all that, but I think probably the majority of my patients would go to tele-enza unless we were saving an ARPI for a clinical trial down the road, and we had discussed that as like a chess match strategy to not burn an ARPI, which is a rare situation for those of you that are listening that probably doesn't apply to you. So I think that's what I do. Now, if they were progressing it on an ARI, right? They were on, Enza or APA or Daro. I think I'm probably going to lean more on olaparib monotherapy in these patients. I don't know that I want to switch the ARI to abiraterone. There's less benefit in going in that direction. There will be added side effects and financial toxicity. So I think I'm going to go monotherapy there. And if it was a non-BRCA1 or 2 mutation, I'm only going to give talazoparib to ATM mutations. Okay, so if I have to give it with Enza, I have to give it with Enza because it's the only one that I've ever seen that the data at least looked maybe there's a signal there. Otherwise, I've really not been enthusiastic about ATM in any other PARP study. And then you have those other ones like the PALB2 and these other ones. I those ones, I'm all including ATM, I'm probably going to lean on chemo first or lutetium first before the PARP inhibitor. Really, just BRCA1 and 2, I'm probably going to lean on the PARP inhibitor before those other two drugs, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, totally agree. I think I would tend to lean more towards the olaparib monotherapy just from the toxicity of
Yeah.
talazoparib tends to be a little bit more toxic and the dosing is a little bit more trickier
Sure.
than olaparib monotherapy, but agree with everything that you said. What about if somebody has visceral metastasis and no other alterations?
And it's just BRCA1 or 2?
No alterations.
Oh, no alterations. And they're progressing on ADT monotherapy, ADT ARPI. Well, I'm going to sequence it. I'm either going to give docetaxel or a platinum taxane-based combination.
So when are you using Pluvicto in that situation?
I wouldn't give it to a patient with liver metastases in this setting because remember, PSMA4 is approved in patients that could tolerate ARPI switch, right? So if you put those aggressive patients, they're going to fall to chemo. I'm giving Pluvicto to patients with maybe oligo progression, slow progression on an ARI. I'm giving it to patients with low volume disease, patients who are older. So it ends up being like 40% of what I do, right? It's a big patient population because you have all these octogenarians where Pluvicto is going to be better quality of life, more friendly. You have a lot of these, oh, the PSA is going up, and now we have 5 spots on a PET scan, but it's CRPC. So we could try zapping everything, or I'm going to just give lutetium. That's where I'm living on that. And I'm going to also say something that is a sin because I just literally am going to contradict myself. I am still looking at the SUV, and maybe that is not because it can help me predict who does better between chemo and Pluvicto, but it helps me be reassured that if I give lutetium, those patients have a good chance of success and aren't going to fall a cliff if I don't give them chemo now. And those
Yeah,
are
makes
those
sense.
patients above 20, right? Essentially.
I don't know that I look at the SUV as much. I definitely look at how long and how much they're progressing and are we seeing new spots? How would you approach somebody where you're seeing a gradual rise in PSA to, two, three consecutive rises, but you're not seeing evidence of new disease on imaging? How do you approach those group of patients? Those are always a little bit trickier for me, especially ones that are tolerating the therapy well and they're doing well, but you gradually see this increase in PSA that's going from like, one to one and a half to three, and then it goes to like three and a half, and then you're imaging, but you're not finding anything, but you're starting to see this gradual increase. I tend to find that those patients, I start talking about Pluvicto as an option because you're starting to see it and you just can't find that disease. But I don't know.
Well, you got to
What do
have
you
the
do?
PSMA on the PET scan to give Pluvicto, though. You're saying
Well,
there's not
you're
new
seeing
spots.
they're not seeing new spots. You're not seeing
Right,
new
the old
spots
spots.
and old spots. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a great place for that. Unless, sometimes I'll do SBRT to, one or two lesions and then keep them on the same drug that they're on. But yes, if they had, say, six spots and they're not growing and you see them on the bone scan or you see them on the PSMA PET scan, then yeah, I do think that's exactly one of those situations that I'm not going to give docetaxel to that patient. I'm probably going to give lutetium. I'm probably not going to give them six cycles. Probably going to give them two or three and then pause, let them do well for a while. And then when they start to progress again, think about completing the six at that time.
Well, but I think I don't have anything else to add for prostate cancer. I know there's a whole section on oligoprogressive disease as well as oligometastatic disease that we can talk about in prostate cancer, which we'll talk about on another podcast. Any other thoughts for prostate cancer for how we're looking forward to in 2026?
No, I think we're excited to see what comes, right? We're waiting some data sets. I don't think anything major in the first third of the year, though. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. Maybe by the time we get into ASCO or ESMO, there might be a little bit more that's exciting in prostate cancer. We have a lot of new molecules. We have a lot of phase three studies in this space that are ongoing. So hopefully we get some readouts that will help our patients.
Great. Well, thank you all for listening to us and joining us on this conversation on the 2025 updates and practice changes in prostate cancer. Please follow us on X at Oncology Decoded and email us at podcast@oncologydecoded. Until next time, thank you.